end of March 2022. However, the current owner has offered to sell us a permanent property easement first, which would give KKFI the legal rights to keep our tower on the land forever and have access to repairs and upgrades, no matter who eventually owns the property itself. This may sound obvious, but in radio, signal reliability is critical, and we have explored the options to maintain our signal after the upcoming sale, and purchasing the easement is the best because it both provides permanent access and will eliminate the current $21,468 in annual rent we pay, which in turn will allow us to invest more in your local programming. To get involved or make a gift, go to kkfi.org/ampup or call 888-931-0901. Thank you so much for listening.
Most times, KKFI moves against the stream, but just saying, play KKFI to your smart speaker will bring our stream to you, KKFI, wherever you are.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. On today's show, this time of year, we always do a legal year-end wrap-up for our Jaws of Justice show on KKFI. This year, special guest Bob I of Kaufman and I and host David Bell of Weirch, Hobbs, and Merakian PC join host Craig Lubo, an attorney, for a panel discussion of legal highlights from 2021. They will discuss civil liberties under court review, particularly the pending abortion cases in the Supreme Court. They will also discuss some of the other big Supreme Court cases decided in 2021. They might discuss media coverage of some trials, including the Rittenhouse, Chauvin, and the Arbery court cases. There were cameras in the courtroom for Rittenhouse. Is this type of gavel-to-gavel coverage good for justice or not? What are the benefits? What are the negatives? We'll play our calendar at the middle of our hour. We hope our listeners are enjoying a wonderful holiday season. Get ready for the days to grow longer and have a safe and happy new year. On Jaws of Justice, we investigate how to achieve justice in America. Justice will not be served until those who are unaffected are as outraged as those who are. Now, our show.
Criminal defense. Okay. All right. This is Craig Lubo, and thank you for joining us here on Jaws of Justice. And today I have with me my co-host, David Bell, and we also have special guest, Bob I. All three of us are attorneys, and I practice in criminal defense. Bob I practices in primarily administrative law, doing environmental cases now. He used to be a criminal defense attorney as well. And David, I believe you do mostly criminal defense, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. So today is our annual review of cases that have happened within the past year, primarily in the past year, and we're going to talk about some of those cases, some of the trials, as well as some of the Supreme Court cases. I think we'll start with, because it's such a big issue with the recent Supreme Court hearing, we'll start with the abortion issue. And this is an issue that Bob I has been following, so I'm going to let Bob I take the lead on that and tell us about that.
Thanks a lot, Craig, and good morning to everybody. Pleasure to be here. Yeah, there are two cases working their way through the United States Supreme Court, and they've both gotten a lot of attention, and they both have profound implications, not only for abortion, but for some basic principles of federalism and other constitutional dimensions out on the horizon as well. Let's talk about the one that was heard in oral argument in November. This is the Texas abortion legislation that's at stake, so-called Senate Bill 8 out of the Texas legislature, that was enacted and signed by Governor Abbott. And it restricts abortion when there's evidence of a fetal heartbeat. Generally, that's around 6 weeks, and it is much sooner than a fetus would be viable outside the womb. Viability has been the touchstone on abortion rights since the Casey versus Planned Parenthood case back in the 1980s. Viability is the generally the consensus is that it's usually around the 22 to 24 week point in a pregnancy. Of course, in Texas now, with a 6 week ban, effectively, most women would not know that they are pregnant. So the case went to the Supreme Court, both on challenges by abortion providers. And the United States Department of Justice also weighed in on this and challenged the Texas legislation as well. During the oral argument, the merits of the Texas legislation really were not touched upon much at all. Those will be for the merits part of this will be held at a subsequent hearing. However, this was an extremely important case because the court was arguing about when an act of the state can be reviewed by the Supreme Court. Now, it's been the law since Marbury versus Madison back in the late 1700s that the United States court system is empowered to review acts of not only the United States Congress, but of state legislatures. And this has been settled law for a long time. That there's, of course, tension between the states and the federal government in terms of the scope of that review. And there are constant attempts to essentially get beyond federal control or federal review. And this Texas case is a really good example of it. You'll remember that in the Texas Senate Bill 8, perhaps one of the most controversial provisions of it empowers individual citizens to bring suit against not only abortion providers, but anybody who would assist a woman in obtaining an abortion. The example that's been used is the Uber driver who drives a woman to the clinic could be the target of a suit by an individual who otherwise has no relationship or interest in the matter at all. This has also complicated things because the Senate Bill 8 specifically says that government officials are not empowered to enforce the law. And this is the wrinkle. Generally, when states take actions, they take actions through officials, elected officials or individuals who are employed by the government, anywhere from the governor down to a police officer on the beat. Those actors are now out of the picture for Senate Bill 8, and it empowers the neighbor across the street or the business owner who happens to have information or a friend or a relative. They are now empowered to bring suit against providers and people who assist in an abortion. The court during its oral arguments really struggled with this question of whether that was a permissible dynamic to set up and thereby allow the act of Texas, Senate Bill 8, that is, to evade review by the federal courts. And this is a very troubling aspect of this case because if the court ultimately agrees with Texas, it will make federal court review of state legislative acts more difficult, and perhaps in some instances it may preclude that review. So this is one that has some extremely important legal questions attached to it, even apart from the fact that it deals with reproductive rights. And because one can very quickly see where essentially activating an entire population to become the enforcement mechanism for particular legislative enactments has the potential, in my view, to set up kind of a hyper-surveillance society, a society that would have neighbors watching neighbors in not a positive and wholesome way, but rather in a way that was very intrusive. And this case really does have the potential to reshape some of the fundamental relationships of the individual to the government and individuals, the relationships with other individuals as well. So in that regard, I'm watching this very carefully, not only because it, as I say, it has to do with abortion rights in a direct way, but also it has to do with these fundamental constitutional questions as well.
David has a question.
I had a quick question. You know, I remember back, I think maybe in law school, there was a idea of restrictive covenants being placed into home ownership documents to prevent the sale to members of religions or various races. And I thought I remember a concept whereby the ability to enforce it in the court still made it kind of a state-like action, meaning in this case, it sounds like Texas is trying to get around having to worry about state action by putting it in the hands of individuals. But those individuals, though, certainly still have to go to court, don't they? And isn't there a problem potentially there where they're asking the court to do something that the state might otherwise be unable to do?
Well, your question's right on point, David, because one of the issues that the court took up was because the among other defendants that were named by the Department of Justice and by the providers, you had court clerks and state court judges that were asked to be enjoined from taking these cases on. And the court in its order of December 10, a few weeks ago, ruled that it was not proper to have court clerks or state district judges as parties to this case. Since the court essentially said that they were not going to be players, in this instance. And they went right through all of the government actors and explained why none of them would be targets for this particular lawsuit, with one exception. And it's a very narrow one. In their December 10 order, they did say that the medical licensing board in Texas could be kept as a defendant because these things would potentially have implications for physicians' licenses and so forth. And so that particular medical regulatory board will remain as a, or the individuals on it would remain as defendants. But that really misses the point because, a person can have a medical license that's perfectly valid, but if they don't have any patients coming in the door or a clinic that's viable because patients are coming in the door, it's going to be kind of a moot point in terms of whether their license is still active. But that's a very good question. And the court struggled with that during oral argument back in November, but like I say, in their December 10 order, they had no trouble whatsoever stating that most government actors were not going to be parties defendant in these cases and that only this licensing board would be.
Right. Bob, this is Craig. I've got a couple questions. First of all, has anything like this ever been done before by any state, not just for abortion, but for any type of issue? And the other question I have is, I think it's Mississippi is the other state. Did the Supreme Court arguments include anything from Mississippi, or is that going to be done separate?
First question, has anything like this been done, or you're essentially setting up a vigilante system for enforcement? I think that there have been some limited attempts at it, but nothing anywhere near the statewide attempt that is being rolled out in Texas. And, it's interesting because the proponents of this try to characterize it as something as benign as kind of a neighborhood watch system. And, I can tell you that a neighborhood watch system generally doesn't carry a $10,000 reward for giving the police a tip on somebody's, you know, house being burglarized or whatever. And that's the difference here, is that there are these $10,000 bounties that are allowed under Senate Bill 8. And that, I think, takes it into a different dimension, and much different than any what states have tried to do before. And again, it's the deviation here is when you generally, when a law is enacted, it's up to the enforcement agencies to see that it is followed. You don't empower the neighbors or the, you know, activists to go out and enforce the law. There are some exceptions to that. Of course, whistleblowers can bring actions sometimes to recover damages for retaliatory firings and so forth. But that's a far different context.
But Bob, isn't this kind of like just going the extra step or the more extreme version of allowing citizen arrest?
It is. It is very much that same thing. The difference is there's not an arrest. Instead, there's a lawsuit that's filed. But it would certainly have the same chilling effect. And in fact, we know that it has a chilling effect because abortions are not being delivered in Texas right now. And they probably won't be for some time. You brought up the Mississippi case, and that is one where Roe v. Wade is on the line. No, there's no, I mean, that is the reason that case is pending before the court right now. Mississippi, the state legislature there enacted a 15-week ban. Essentially, after 15 weeks, abortions would now be permitted. Again, this is contrary to the viability rule set down in Supreme Court jurisprudence, and has the effect of essentially overturning Roe, if that's what happens. The court is, I think that over during the oral arguments, which I listened to, it was very clear that the court is in three essentially separate groups. The group of five, Thomas, Alito, Kavanaugh, Barrett, and Gorsuch seem pretty well united that Roe has to be overturned. I saw very little indication of any moving around on that issue, much at all. The three liberals on the court, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan, did a great job during the oral arguments of pointing out the radical departure from Supreme Court jurisprudence and the unintended effects that would likely happen to women across this country if Roe goes away. That case, I think, is probably going to result in I should add, the group of one is Chief Justice Roberts, who would like to find some kind of middle ground between the group of five and the group of three. But unfortunately, during oral arguments, the comments that he made, which were along the lines at one point that, well, 15 weeks, you know, that's not that much different than 22 or 23 or 24 weeks. Why wouldn't we just allow 15 weeks to be the marker instead of 21 or 22, 23 weeks? And I think that the answer to that really has to do with, again, viability. You cannot have a viable fetus at 15 weeks. And so if you abandon viability, then Roe and its progeny, Casey, will be effectively abandoned, and we will have no more abortion rights that are protected by the United States Constitution. And, you know, it's troubling not only because of we see these rights potentially slipping away or being limited to the prerogatives of the states, but I think it's important to remember that preceding Roe by about 8 years was the case of Griswold against Connecticut, in which the question of availability of contraception was taken up. And the court there found that there was a fundamental right on the United States Constitution for access to contraception, using many of the same principles that the court in Roe used to say that there was access to abortion. So, you know, the question has to be raised, I think, what's next? If they're successful in Roe, you know, what other fundamental rights are going to be, whittled away? And, so it's troubling in many respects. And I think that, it's going to have a particularly profound effect in states like Missouri and Kansas. For example, Missouri has already passed so-called trigger legislation that says if Roe is abandoned by the state's United States Supreme Court, at that point, abortion will be banned in Missouri. So the United States Supreme Court is going to have to decide the Mississippi case sometime before the end of June of 2022. They could decide it today. And if they do, then abortion rights in Missouri and I think 14 or 15 other states have passed this trigger legislation, including Oklahoma. Those go away. Abortion will then be banned in those states. Kansas is a little bit different. In 2019, our Supreme Court ruled in the Hodes versus Schmidt case that women in Kansas have a fundamental right under the state constitution to abortion access. Well, the reaction to that was that the anti-choice factions in the legislature crafted a proposed constitutional amendment that would say specifically that abortion rights are not part of our state constitution, and that the adoption of that amendment will be on the primary election ballot in Kansas on the first Tuesday of August of 2022. Now, the cynics might point out that in a typical primary election in Kansas, you, for every three Republican voters, you have about one or one and a half Democrat voters. So it's, I think the cynic might also point out that had they tried to, make this proposed constitutional amendment, put it on the general election ballot, it probably would have lost pretty badly. And this is all against the backdrop that in survey after survey over the years, there's been, even in Kansas, there's been well over 50% support for abortion rights. I mean, sometimes it gets up into the low 60%. And yet we have this consistent pattern in the legislature and with some governors as well, who are very hostile to abortion rights, notwithstanding their strong support in the public.
Okay, we just have a few minutes left before our first break. David had a comment. I think he was referring to the $10,000 bounty that you mentioned. Didn't we have the same thing when back during slavery in terms of catching slaves?
Yeah, the Fugitive Slave Act, and even before the Fugitive Slave Act was adopted, a state, I think the first state to put a bounty on runaway slaves was Georgia. And it really, I take that back. I think it was South Carolina when I think about it. But nevertheless, it did set this rather unfortunate precedent for putting bounties on individuals' heads and then encouraging members of the public to pursue those bounties. And yes, it unfortunately does have a real similarity to the Fugitive Slave Acts and the similar laws that were in effect in the slavery times in the South.
All right. So for those just joining us, this is Craig Lubow, and I'm here with my co-host David Bell, and we have special guest Bob I. And we are talking about legal developments in the Supreme Court within the past year, as well as in the state courts, and also some of the trials have taken place, and we'll talk about some of those when we come back from our break, which we get to take in a moment. Among those, we'll talk about the Rittenhouse case, which was a defendant up in Wisconsin, the Kim Potter case that was just decided this past week in Minnesota, and the Armred case, I'm not sure if I said that right, in Georgia, which involved a former police officer where they chased down a black guy, he and his son. And so we're going to talk about those cases and a few others when we come back. All right, so stay tuned.
Support for KKFI comes from Union Station and Auschwitz, the exhibition. Not long ago, not far away. The exhibition at Union Station features over 700 original objects and over 400 historic images. This comprehensive exhibition is dedicated to the history of Auschwitz and its role in the Holocaust. Auschwitz, not long ago, not far away. The exhibition. Now extended through March at Union Station. More information and reserved tickets are available now at unionstation.org.
KKFI has a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity right now to amp up for the future and secure access to our tower forever and remove over $21,000 in rent that we pay every year by purchasing an easement, which is a restriction placed on the property where our tower sits that gives KKFI permanent access for repairs and upgrades no matter who owns the land. To learn more about how to support this $350,000 campaign, go to kkfi.org/ampup or call 888-931-0901. We only have until March 31st, 2022, and I am very happy to say the first $90,000 will be matched by a generous group of KKFI supporters. Please consider this gift above what you normally do for KKFI and double your year-end gift right now, or make it a larger gift over a couple of years. All the info is at kkfi.org/ampup or call 888-931-0901. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. I want to update you on the Amp Up for the Future campaign. We have topped $118,000 so far in this investment in KKFI's future. That means we still have $76,000 in matching commitments from a group of wonderful KKFI supporters. Whether it's a one-time gift or a commitment over a couple of years, please consider an extra gift above your normal generosity. Or, of course, make your first gift right now and it will be matched dollar for dollar. To double your gift to KKFI right now, go to kkfi.org/AmpUp or call 888-931-0901. Again, that's kkfi.org/AmpUp or call 888-931-0901. Thank you for listening.
Now the calendar for the week of December 27th. If you haven't been vaccinated yet, you can find a vaccine. See the facts at kcmo.gov. Legal Aid of Western Missouri can provide free civil legal services to low-income and vulnerable people who live in Jackson County, Missouri. Interested individuals can call 816-474-6750 to apply. For Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense virtual meetings this week, go to momsdemandaction.org. All are welcome, mothers and others. Monday Meets is December 27th at 4 p.m., an online event hosted by the Willow Domestic Violence Center, open to everyone on Facebook Live. Friday, December 31st, from 2 to 4 p.m., the Penny Mill Annual Bowling Excursion is at Diamond Bowl, 218 North Osage, Independence, Missouri. Everyone is invited to this no-cost event, with food, drinks, bowling, and prizes for kids. All cultures are welcome. Penny Mill wants us to empower our children. A list of services, meals, and hotlines are available at lawrenceprogressivecalendar.blogspot.com. That list is updated daily. Please take care of yourselves and others. My name is Terry, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Stan Thomas. Have a safe and happy New Year's Day. Let's return to our legal roundtable with Craig Lubo, David Bell, and Bob I.
All right. Thank you for staying with us. This is Craig Lubo. We're back on Jaws of Justice. Again, my co-host is David Bell, and our special guest is Bob I. And we are talking about legal cases from the past year. So we're going to transition from abortion to some of the trials that have taken place this year, including the Rittenhouse case, Kyle Rittenhouse in Wisconsin, and the Kim Potter case in Minnesota, the Derek Chauvin case in Minnesota, and the case in Georgia. And these cases all involve an element of self-defense, or the alleged self-defense. And I don't think any of those states involve specifically the stand your ground laws, but David Bell's going to take the lead on this issue. And I'm going to ask you, David, to maybe address, because many states do have stand your ground, if you can explain to our listeners what the difference is between self-defense and stand your ground. So I'm going to have David talk about this, but while I do have a couple comments later on the Rittenhouse case.
Sure. And, you know, I appreciate that. And this, it interestingly enough, relates very much to Bob's conversation that I really enjoyed about kind of this desire to to allow individuals to be the determination of their own law, if you will, is really fascinating to me. But there's two things I want you to think about as we go through this discussion. First of all, don't confuse what you think is the right way of doing things with the law, or stated differently, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. And I want to be clear about that. I'm not knocking the law, but I want to ask you to consider my belief, at least, that the law sets the floor of human behavior, not the ideal. An example, if I saw one of you fall with your face in an inch of water, covering your nose and mouth, and you're unconscious, and I'm not at risk if I were to come over and help you. If I don't help you, I don't believe there's any criminal penalty for my failure to help. That even if there's no risk to myself. And so, again, I want to go back to, in my opinion, the law generally sets the floor of human behavior, not the ideal. And the other thing I'd ask you to consider is be careful how you project your own biases. And I know I do myself. And you've remembered in the Rittenhouse case when the judge kicked the gun charge. I know that was a big moment. And everyone thought, oh, geez, the fix is in. We've got an older white guy who made goofy comments. I remember he made a comment, quote, I hope the Asian food isn't on one of those boats in Long Beach Harbor. I don't know what that was intended to mean, but it sure sounded goofy to me when it came out. But we need to get past those things for a second and actually look to the law. And the current wording of that law with regard to the gun said that any person under 18 years of age who possesses or goes armed with a dangerous weapon is guilty of a Class A misdemeanor. Now, Kyle Rittenhouse was 17 at the time. However, that section only applies to persons under 18 years of age who possess or are armed with a rifle or shotgun, which is short-barreled. And the state never proved the length of the barrel. And, in fact, I think the state actually agreed that the barrel was not a short barrel. And so the kicking of that charge itself, although it came from someone who looked like was on Kyle Rittenhouse's side, to the extent you can project that, was done based on what I can read from this, the law. So what we really need to focus on are not the individual actors sometimes, although we like to project kind of these issues into these individual cases. But going back to what Bob was talking about is really the statutes that are passed, and in the case of criminal law, the jury instructions that are created. Because it's the jury instructions that really, really is where the rubber meets the road. And just so everyone's aware, there may be a law that something is bad or don't do something and there's a criminal sanction for it. But when it gets down to it in a court of law, you've got jury instructions that tell jurors that if this, then this. And so it's somewhat mechanical in how a jury goes through the instructions to answer. And it's in those weeds, if you will, that a lot of these cases can be evaluated and should be evaluated rather than kind of our own general thoughts about what should happen or should not happen. To be clear, a mother should not be dropping off a 17-year-old with an AR-15 to go police the streets. I think that's absurd. That being said, my view on that is not necessarily relevant to analysis of the law. So when we look to the jury instructions here, the first one is there's no duty to retreat. And actually the jury instruction in this case said there is no duty to retreat. The next thing is provocation. You should also consider whether the defendant provoke the attack. A person who is engaged in unlawful conduct of a type likely to provoke others to attack and who does provoke an attack is not allowed to use or threaten self-defense against that attack. Well, does everyone want to know what is not unlawful, or stated differently, what is lawful in Kenosha? It is actually lawful to open carry a gun in Wisconsin without a permit. So whereas I may see someone walking down the street here with an AR-15, and I may think, my God, that's certainly aggressive, and that's certainly a provocation, there it's not a provocation. And so what you have is you have a hyped-up situation in the case of Rittenhouse, where you have it's hyped up in terms of there's a lot of emotion, a lot of anxiety, a lot of anger going on. You have multiple people in the street with guns, and it becomes the Wild West. And the problem, the way the law is written, is the Wild West is essentially permitted. And the only winners and losers are the losers are the ones that get shot, and the winners are the ones, I guess, that do the shooting and get away. And that's how the law is written. So the witnesses testified at trial that the first man shot and killed, Joseph Rosenbaum, was, quote, hyper-aggressive, acting belligerently that night, and threatened to kill Rittenhouse at one point. Well, should someone be allowed to use self-defense if someone is threatening to kill you and you have a reasonable belief as to that, even though your presence at the scene with a gun is absurd? If you're there at the time and someone threatens to kill you, should you be able to use that? One witness said Rosenbaum was gunned down after he chased Rittenhouse and lunged for the young man's rifle. Well, what was Rittenhouse to think at that point? And then Rittenhouse's killing set in motion the bloodshed that followed moments later. Rittenhouse killed Anthony Huber, a 26-year-old protester seen on bystander video, hitting Rittenhouse with a skateboard. And then Rittenhouse then wounded the final person, and this was the person that actually had the gun. This was the gentleman that lost part of his bicep. A protester and volunteer medic wounded on the streets of Kenosha by Kyle Rittenhouse testified Monday that he was pointing his own gun at the rifle-toting Rittenhouse, unintentionally, he said, when the young man shot him. And so you have a situation where there is no, and you go back to the stand your ground law, there's different, I think, aspects of it, that we need to consider. But one of the considerations is essentially what it permits people to do is it gives them the right or it takes away the obligation to, de-escalate conflict. If you have the right to be there, I'm going to be here. It's almost like if you remember in The Simpsons where the little girl, she would wave her arms around in kind of a windmill type fashion. And she'd say, I'm coming at you, Bart. And if you're in the way when I get there, it's not my fault that you're in there. And so you've got this play out where nobody has an obligation to de-escalate the situation and everyone's armed up. And so what happens in this kind of MMA kind of fighting arena, the society is supposed to just accept as if that's okay. And so the Rittenhouse decision, well, again, I think it's absurd that a 17-year-old would be walking around with an AR-15 based on the law, at least as I can tell, was not out of line.
One of the things that the judge did, you mentioned before, he seemed to be, I guess, biased, for lack of a better way of saying it. And I definitely, when I watched it, a lot of this was televised and most of it on court TV. And it seemed like numerous statements he made signaled to the jury that he thought the defendant was innocent. And some of the comments about Asian food really made me feel like this judge was probably a white supremacist who was conducting a trial. And one of the interesting things was he gave, a good 3 to 5 minute sermon, if you will, about how we should not use the words victim and defendant in the trial. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? And
sure.
I will mention too, I just recently had a criminal case where we did a deposition and the prosecutor kept using the word victim. So I objected to that using learning from the Rittenhouse case.
So I've been in a number of trials where, let's say a murder trial where someone has been killed by a gunshot. So they're definitely a victim of a homicide. but I have still requested that the court instruct the prosecutor not to use the word victim. And the reason is it's conclusory as to the person on trial at that moment. My client is innocent until proven guilty. My client has said that he didn't commit a crime. Either he didn't shoot the person or he did with self-defense. And so therefore that person is not a victim, if you will, of my client, if we're going to presume my client innocent. And so that's part of the problem. As to the use of the word defendant, I don't think I've gotten into that much, but as you say it, my thought is, you know, part of the issue that I have and when I go to trial is my job is to humanize my client. The use of numbers, pictures, lineup photos, the word defendant, I think are all intended, frankly, to dehumanize the client. And I think that can go to my client's disadvantage when the jury goes back to make a decision.
Okay, so let's talk about the police accountability cases, if you will.
Sure. So
Derek Chauvin from Minneapolis and Kim Potter, who was the most recent one, and then the former police officer in Georgia. And sure. Let's talk about, well, this was really a first this year, to hold three of them like that accountable. Of course, we don't want to have open season on police officers and stifle the ability to protect us, but at the same time, we want to make sure those who are violating those and not protecting us or doing something wrong, that those are in fact held accountable. So talk about those cases.
Yeah, just briefly on Chauvin, you know, he was convicted of three different charges. And this is something I don't understand. We don't have that in Missouri where it looks like you're convicted of the top charge, the lesser included and the lesser included under that. But I'll leave that for something else. But I want to, in Chauvin, what was fascinating about that is the top level crime was felony murder. So I want to distinguish, and this is what, it's a great charging decision, it seems like, on the prosecutor. If I go to steal a car, in Missouri, and, I'm caught, or at least I'm spotted, and I'm chased, and during that chase, I hit someone and kill them, a cyclist, let's say, or someone walking in the street. And I never had an intention to murder that cyclist. I was trying to get away. However, as the law is written, I am guilty of second degree murder as if I took out a gun and shot the person. And that was what happened in Chauvin, at least at the top charge. And I'll read the elements. Again, I really ask ladies and gentlemen listening that if you want to know more about a case, look up jury instructions for the specific case so you can see when we take away the media and all the commentary, even the obvious biases potentially of judges or others, participants, the jury instructions are where it's at. The death of George Floyd must be proven. That was the first element. Second element, that the defendant caused the death of George Floyd. The third element was the defendant at the time of causing the death of George Floyd was committing or attempting to commit the felony offense of assault in the third degree. It is not necessary for the state to prove that the defendant had an intent to kill George Floyd, but it must prove that defendant committed or attempted to commit the underlying felony of assault in the third degree. And there are two elements of assault in the third degree. Assault is the intentional infliction of bodily harm upon another or the attempt to inflict bodily harm upon another, and that in this case the defendant inflicted substantial bodily harm on George Floyd. It is not necessary for the state to prove that the defendant intended to inflict substantial bodily harm or knew that his actions would inflict substantial bodily harm, only that the defendant intended to commit the assault and that as a result of the assault George Floyd sustained substantial bodily harm. And so we have that. Now the other part of that is, and there's a few other charges I won't go through, the second element of this, which you'll see in these police cases, is the ability of the police officer to use force to effectuate an arrest, generally. And so the instructions in the Chauvin case were no crime is committed if a police officer's actions were justified by the police officer's use of reasonable force in the line of duty of effectuating a lawful arrest or preventing an escape from custody. The kind and degree of force a police officer may lawfully use in executing his duties is limited by what a reasonable police officer in the same situation would believe to be necessary. Any use of force beyond that is not reasonable. And then it goes on from that. And so when you look at that instruction, you know, it would seem to me just from the video that I've seen and the little bit I know about the case, that the initial knee to the back would probably have been acceptable initially, whether it's permitted under the guidelines of the law enforcement or not, would probably have been okay. But the sustained knee to the back and to the neck is probably what the, and I think it was over 9 minutes, is probably where the use of force went from reasonable to unreasonable. But I'd be interested as to what Craig, you and Bob have to say about that.
Yeah, Bob, you want to say something?
Thanks. Yes, Bob. I agree with you. I think that the instructions are often overlooked, and yet they are so key to how what jurors take back with them to deliberate the case. I mean, it is important to note they get the instructions right at the end of the case, sometimes before or before closing arguments, and sometimes after, but they get it at the tail end. And, you know, as far as these underlying acts, juries usually get it right. They usually get fact questions right. Not always, but they usually do. And I think in this one that they certainly did. In the context of what Chauvin was confronted with, it certainly would be reasonable for a juror to conclude that George Floyd's, the fact that he did not present an imminent threat, certainly once he was disabled, he didn't. I think if for most jurors at that point, it would be a short step to say that he was committing that third degree assault at the time. Contextually, had there been a big struggle where you had three cops trying to restrain Floyd for an extended period of time, puts it into an entirely different kind of realm. But in this one, it just appeared that that third degree assault, the knee in the back, knee in the neck rather, was not necessary in order to protect the officer's safety. And I think the jury, and frankly, the arguments that Chauvin and his lawyer advanced to contrary to that just really never got much traction, it appears.
You know, moving on really quick to the Kimberly Potter case, and this was the case where the police officer indicated she was reaching for a taser but reached for a firearm and shot the decedent. And it was Dante Wright was the gentleman's name. Real quick on this, and I haven't seen this in Missouri law, but she was convicted of two charges. In the first charge, and again, ladies and gentlemen, I want to go back. We all have opinions kind of as to what the right result is, and I appreciate that, and that sure is fun for me to be a Facebook warrior and to talk on the radio, but again, you have to go to the underlying law of it. Here, she was charged with causing the death of Dante Wright while committing the misdemeanor offense of reckless handling or use of a firearm so as to endanger the safety of another with such force and violence that death or great bodily harm to any person was reasonably foreseeable. That's what she was convicted of. And so if you think about that, and here are the elements of that, that first, that the defendant caused the death of Dante Wright, and that second, that the death of Dante Wright was caused by defendant committing the crime of reckless handling or use of a firearm. And person acts recklessly if under the totality of the circumstances she commits a conscious or intentional act in connection with the handling or use of a firearm that could create some substantial and unjustifiable risk that she is aware of and disregards. And second, that the defendant handled or used the firearm so as to endanger the safety of another person. It is not necessary, and this is part of the instructions, it is not necessary for the state to prove any intent on the part of the defendant to kill anyone. And so when you hear it like that, I think it's a lot of times for those of us that are against the decision in that case, when you read through the instructions like that, you're like, well, wait a minute. There was certainly a reckless component there by grabbing the wrong instrument and by using it. I get that. That was reckless, potentially, and did a death result from that recklessness? And I think the answer is yes. And so, therefore, a conviction, I think, becomes much more likely than looking at it as to whether the fight is, does she intentionally mean to kill someone? And I think from looking at it, it appears that there was no intent. But if you can see or get in the instruction, it says it is not necessary for the state to prove any intent on the part of the defendant to kill anyone. I don't know what are your guys' thoughts on that?
Bob, you want?
Yes, Bob. David, so in other words, all the time that Potter spent on the stand and the comments made by her counsel about intent were really sort of purposeless.
Correct. It sounded to me almost like a jury nullification. Like, ladies and gentlemen, this was a mistake. She never intended to do it. The issue, though, is whether she was reckless, in, at least on the first charge, the handling or use of a firearm. The second charge, she was also found guilty as manslaughter in the second degree. And this is, did the defendant cause the death of Dante Wright by culpable negligence, whereby the defendants created an unreasonable risk and consciously took a chance of causing death or great bodily harm? And culpable negligence is intentional conduct that the defendant may not have intended to be harmful, but that an ordinary and reasonably prudent person would recognize as involving a strong probability of injury to the to others. And then again, it says it is not necessary for the state to prove any intent on the part of the defendant to kill anyone. And I think what I'm seeing in this decision, and Bob, I'd be curious as to your thoughts, is that with the ability to take a gun out and kill somebody comes a substantial responsibility. And I guess the responsibility, as we see the dial moving a little bit, is that when police officers do that, they need to get it right.
Yeah, and I think that this goes right along with the whole re-examination of the role of qualified immunity, where essentially there's something of a legal presumption that protects use of force by police officers. And I think that the fact that qualified immunity is now becoming a more targeted discussion about, you know, just exactly how it works and whether it ought to be out there as a defense goes along with this whole question that you just raised, David, about as far as intent and so forth.
Well, I wonder, Bob, if you could briefly talk about that. And the reason I think it's important for people to understand is for qualified immunity, the ability to sue essentially a police officer, it's almost impossible to overcome, as I understand it. And so it seems like the community's desire for some justice has to come out somewhere, and perhaps it comes out here, almost like squeezing a balloon and the air pushes out one direction versus the other.
Yeah, qualified immunity is essentially, you know, in times past, there was absolute immunity. The king could do no wrong and all of that. Well, we've scaled that back somewhat now in the context of law enforcement to raise the bar in order to bring a successful claim against a law enforcement officer for excessive use of force. You really have to be able to establish that there was an unreasonable aspect to the officer's conduct. That the officer is acting out of motives that were not related to law enforcement necessarily. And as you say, that's a really tough bar to clear in most cases.
Greg.
We have 2 minutes left, and I just want to ask one real quick question on reasonable force issue. Is the standard the same if it's a private citizen versus a police officer?
Oh, that's interesting. So, you know, here, I'm looking at the authorized use of deadly force. This is in the Kim Potter case. With respect to any alleged use of a firearm, Minnesota law provides that no crime is committed and a police officer's actions are justified only when the police officer uses deadly force in the line of duty when necessary to protect a police officer or another from apparent death or great bodily harm, or affect the arrest or capture of a person whom the police officer knows or has reasonable grounds to believe has committed or attempted to commit a felony involving the use or threatened use of deadly force, and et cetera. I think in the stand your ground, well, I'm sorry, the Castle Doctrine, I believe that is a similar idea in that if there is some forcible felony, for example, in Missouri on a car or in a house, then you have the right to shoot.
And we're down to 1 minute. And I did want to just quickly mention too, David, in Kansas, felony murder in most situations is the same as first degree murder. So I want to thank everybody for listening. We've been talking to Bob I, David Bell, and I've been on the panel. We've been talking about legal cases. And stay tuned. We are out of time, so thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The Senate will come to order. Under the previous order, the Senate stands adjourned until 4:30 p.m. on Monday, December 27th, 2021.
Both chambers of Congress are on a holiday break. The House and Senate held a brief pro forma session Thursday, and another is planned Monday, but neither chamber will take up any legislation until the new year. The holidays may not be holly jolly for Democrats who missed a self-imposed year-end deadline to pass the Build Back Better Act and voting rights legislation. Democratic leaders plan to tackle both issues in January. To get the bills through the Senate, particularly to bolster voting rights and counter restrictive GOP laws at the state level, President Joe Biden told ABC News he'll support filibuster reform, reversing course on weeks of opposition to the proposal. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki reinforced the president's position Thursday.
We may not have to go to that, but he is prepared to support changes if that's the only thing standing in the way of getting this done.
Kim Potter, the former Minneapolis area police officer charged with killing Dante Wright in April, has been found guilty on two charges of manslaughter. Judge Regina Chu placed Wright in police custody without bail until her sentencing in February. Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison, whose office led the prosecution, says the decision represented accountability for Potter's actions, but not justice for Wright.
Justice would be restoring Dante to life and making the Wright family whole again. Justice is beyond the reach that we have in this life for Dante. But accountability is an important step.
In Michigan, a petition is seeking to bypass the state's legislative process to implement new restrictive voting laws, previously vetoed by Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Christina Schlitt, co-president of the League of Women Voters of Michigan, says the petition needs the equivalent of 8% of the turnout for the last gubernatorial election, after which the Republican-held state legislature can bypass Whitmer.
If they do get the 340,047 good signatures, then the legislature can simply adapt it.
President Biden has signed a bill authorizing additional research and funding for ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. The bipartisan bill, which passed Congress with near unanimous support, will allocate $100 million annually for ALS research and support through 2026.
It's about showing the American people that as a country, we can come together, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, and do big things because they're the best researchers in the world.
And finally, the Supreme Court will convene a special session January 7th to weigh the legality of the president's vaccine requirements. The justices will consider challenges to two different issues, the administration's vaccine or test policy for some employers and a vaccine requirement for healthcare workers. I'm Jonah Chester for Pacifica Network and Public News Service, and Lily Bolke contributed reporting. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Enjoyed today's show, and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, send email inquiries and comments to kkfi.org/contact. This is Terry, reminding you that our outro music is Better Man from the Plane for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9, followed by Understanding Israel-Palestine at 9:30 on Fridays. Up next is Link's Mix with Mixmaster Link, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the Afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo Enno.